From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Split show for you tonight. Later on, a glimpse into other realities with Cynthia Sue Larson and also Auras. Here's what's happening. A new virus responsible for an outbreak of respiratory illness in the Middle East, the virus we've been reporting on, now may be more deadly than SARS, according to a team of infectious disease specialists who recently investigated a set of cases in Saudi Arabia. Of the 23 confirmed cases back in April, 15 people died, a 65% high fatality rate. Saudi officials say as of Wednesday, 49 people have contracted this disease, 32 people have died. What concerns these investigators? Not just the amount, the number, of course, it's very small. The high fatality rate is absolutely staggering. Researchers find that nearly 70% of Americans are on at least one prescription drug, and more than half receive at least two prescriptions. Is that you? Mayo Clinic researchers report that antibiotics, antidepressants, and painkillers are the most common prescriptions given to Americans. 20% of all U.S. patients were also found to be on five or more prescription medications. Dr. Peter Bragan, one of his works, Medication Madness, he's with us now. Peter, I guess we're over-medicating, aren't we?
Oh, it's become a disaster. It's a giant social experiment. When the number two and three drugs after antibiotics or antidepressants and painkillers, we are messing with our brains. And there's no doubt where this comes from. It comes from the collaboration between the pharmaceutical industry and the medical industry. There's hardly a doctor who's in a leadership role who's willing to stand up and say, guys, we got to cut loose from the drug companies. Human beings are vulnerable. You know, George, it's why we had prohibition. It was a mistaken attempt to keep people from overdoing alcohol. It's why we have limits on cigarettes. It's, why we have drug laws. Human beings are very vulnerable to wanting to use drugs. But now we're in a situation where people are being told to take drugs, and especially these psychiatric drugs, for almost anything that emotionally distresses them. The drugs are given out from the usual things like insomnia, but also for stress. They're given out for fatigue. You can't go to a doctor now and say that you're achy all over, and if you don't have a fever, not get a drug, a psychiatric drug.
Why are they over-medicating, Peter? What's behind it?
Oh, I think there's a couple of very obvious reasons. It really does start with the collaboration between the drug industry and the bought doctors in the leadership roles throughout the country. Psychiatry and pediatrics are so intertwined with the psychiatric drug industry that they're basically, salespersons for the drug industry. It's a shame, and it's a horror, and it's the truth. And it doesn't matter whether you look at the journal editors or the journals or the associations or the leading people giving the medical credits that doctors take, the education courses, or the new diagnostic manual. It's a perfect example. We've come out with this new psychiatric diagnostic manual, and now if you are a person who loses a loved one and you are depressed for a couple of weeks, you will get labeled with major depressive disorder.
Well,
so an ordinary life experience like that causes you to get a mental illness.
Well, Peter, we are overprescribed, no doubt, and thanks what you do. The head of Russia's cyberspace policy called for global governments to react to the NSA spy scandal by creating a United Nations-style body that would have regulatory control over the Internet, including a web kill switch. Lauren Weinstein, who watches all these Internet stories for us, a web kill switch, Lauren, how would that work?
It wouldn't work. The Internet is highly distributed. There isn't a kill switch now. It's not. There's no conceivable way you could really build one. I think you have to look beyond the kill switch talk to what the Russians are really doing here. And this has kind of become typical for them, because even before they had these NSA stories to grab onto, you will recall, we discussed this at some length some time back, they were pushing for a UN takeover of Internet regulation. This is only really a matter of months ago that this got voted down. But they really want it. They want it a lot. A lot of other countries want it, too, because they want to be able to censor. They want to be able to control the Internet their way. Unfortunately, this NSA story has handed them the perfect excuse to bring this all up again. And in fact, the Russians just yesterday, in the course of talking about this story, are using parts of the story that have already been completely discredited and treating them as if they're true. So you can see the damage here is very great, and the blowback that can occur in terms of affecting the whole Internet and freedom of speech on the Internet could be extraordinary. It's a very bad situation.
Well, and you can see, Lauren, with what happened at the Arab Spring and some of the civil unrest that is going on right now in Turkey, that governments would love to be able to shut down those social networks instantly, wouldn't they?
Yeah, and in fact, the first thing they are now trying to do, sometimes they do it preemptively now, once they feel something's going to happen, or if a leader is going to make an announcement that they think may generate discourse, they know now that people, especially younger people, are organizing over the Internet, over Facebook, over Twitter, or using text messages. So they will attempt to shut down Internet connectivity, cell phone connectivity, text messaging, all of that. If the UN had control of the Internet, and we saw this, we saw what they wanted to do in this recent round, many of these kinds of actions that countries would want to take to cut off the Internet from their people, they couldn't cut off the whole Internet. There's not going to be an Internet kill switch. But in terms of individual countries, they could cause a lot of damage. The ways they could do that could be put into international law if the UN had control. So as you can imagine, that's not something that I or most people that are involved in terms of keeping the Internet free would want to see happen.
Lauren, I get lots of requests for your website. Would you spell it out for us, please?
Yeah, the easiest way to get to it is just to go to Vortex, VORTEX.com, Vortex.com, and then there's links there to my blog and to my Google Plus presence and the other venues where I write various things.
Super. Thank you, Lauren Weinstein. A new, faster version of Wi-Fi has been officially rubber-stamped. The latest Wi-Fi technology, called 802.11ac, offers speeds up to 1.3 gigabits per second. That's fast enough now to transfer an entire high-definition movie to a tablet in under 4 minutes. It will double the top speed of the previous standard. How about that? In just over 30 years, they say, humans will be able to upload their entire minds to computers and become digitally immortal, an event called Singularity, according to futurists, something we've been talking about on this show for years. Genetically modified crops are probably safer than conventional plants, according to the European Union's environmental secretary, making the strongest call yet for the adoption of the technology. He said that the GM foods have significant benefits for farmers, consumers, and the environment. He said the next generation of GM crops offers the most wonderful opportunities to improve human health. Jeffrey Smith, you must be rattling in a cage right now over this one, huh?
It's another one of those comedy hours in the European government. At the same time, the EU ombudsman acknowledged that the European Food Safety Authority failed to act on conflicts of interest because one of their former chief reviewers of GMOs took the chief lobbying position for the biotech company Syngenta. So it goes back and forth, just like in the United States, it goes back and forth there. It turns out that the secretary, the environment secretary, completely overlooked the fact that the overuse of herbicides on these genetically engineered herbicide-tolerant crops causes a more than half a billion-pound increase in the use of herbicides, growing pest-resistant crops. The insecticide producing corn and cotton has produced resistance among bugs. There's decline of the monarch butterfly populations because of the herbicides killing the habitat. And there's a new peer-reviewed study that shows that non-GMO farming in Europe outperforms GM farming in North America. So he's basically turning a blind eye to everything that science recognizes and just playing from the playbook of Monsanto and the biotech industry in order to win some points.
All right, Jeffrey, thank you so much. Now, we've all heard the stories. Big banks pleading guilty, allowing Mexican and Colombian drug cartels to launder at least $881 million. What the heck is going on? Up next, Robert Maser joins us. His book, The Infiltrator, he's next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Let me tell you about our special guest tonight. Robert Maser has earned global acclaim as one of the world's leading experts on the financial escapades of the underworld. There's no one with more firsthand knowledge about how this international bank cartel and businesses cater to those who own the nearly, get this, $2 trillion in criminal proceeds laundered every year. For years, in the eyes of organized crime leaders, he was a highly successful mob-connected money launderer that helped manage their illicit fortunes. His clients, some of the most famous and deadly drug cartel bosses, offered a price tag and a big one for his head when arrests were made around the world and he was revealed to be a highly trained U.S. federal undercover agent. Here's Robert Maser back on Coast to Coast. What a risky job, Robert. How are you?
Oh, I'm fine, thank you, and thanks for inviting me back.
Has this stopped or does it continue?
It continues, and it's going to continue. It's going to continue until we get the message to the international banking community by jailing those bankers who are involved in this type of activity rather than fining their banks, as what was done in the HSBC issue. There's been some very credible studies about the amount of money that's generated every year, not just from the sale of illegal drugs, but from other type of criminal activity as well. This is basically money-seeking secrecy from governments. And as you noted, when you introduced me, it's pegged at roughly $2 trillion, and that's a number that was identified by the United Nations on Drugs and Crime report that was issued in October of 2011, and they did a very detailed study about that $2 trillion, $400 billion a year of which comes from the sale of illegal drugs around the world. And that happens every year. And the sad thing is that when you look at our success in identifying and seizing that money, it's terrible. You can go to the Department of Justice Asset Forfeiture website and see every year what the statistics are. And every year there's no more, and there's far less than, but even giving the estimate of $1 billion a year in drug proceeds laundered, that's 0.25% of what's generated around the globe. And most of it is generated in U.S. dollars because it's a global currency that's accepted not just in the legal markets, but the illegal markets all over the world.
Robert, this may be a full show on its own, but I've always talked about the possibility of legalizing some of these drugs in order to break the backs of these cartels. Is that doable?
You know, I think we're at a time when an intelligent discussion should be had with regard to cannabis. But I find it hard to imagine how we can, as a free society, really seriously think about making readily available or making it legal for individuals to possess and use drugs like methamphetamine, crack cocaine,
yeah.
Those types of drugs and the destruction on lives that they impose is just unbelievable. I was a federal agent for 27 years, but I've been in the private sector now for almost 14 years, where I, among other things, help law firms that have clients who are seeking substantial assistance from the government. These are basically cooperators, and in the drug world, I get the opportunity to debrief them about what's going on today. And I can tell you that the devastation of methamphetamine to the lives of individuals is just unbelievable. It has caused many, many deaths. And now we haven't even begun to talk about the diversion of legal drugs like Oxycontin, oxycodone, mm-hmm. The pill problem, which is responsible for more deaths in Florida than any drug, any illegal drug that's out there. So, I'd like to see us get into an intelligent discussion about cannabis because we have a problem here. We have a federal government that says that marijuana is a Schedule I drug, which means that it is highly addictive and that it has no medical purpose. Yet we have 17 states and the District of Columbia, which have laws that have passed medical use for marijuana, saying that it does have a medical purpose. And we have two states in Washington and Oregon that have, Washington and Colorado, that have passed laws legalizing the use of marijuana, the possession of individual use amounts of marijuana, up to an ounce, is perfectly legal in those two states. So that discussion, I think, could be had. But I don't think that that is really going to take a huge bite out of the Mexican cartels and the Colombian cartels. Really, methamphetamine and cocaine and heroin are the major money getters for those organizations.
How strong are those cartels, Robert? And I mean, if we really declared war on them, would they fight back and fight back in a big way?
Well, that's the argument that some people in Mexico made about the Calderon presidency and their position of taking a very aggressive attack on the cartels, that it increased the violence. And I know that the new president in Mexico is taking a little bit different posture with respect to how to go about attacking the drug cartels there. But those cartels, those are narco-terrorist organizations that, among other things, most importantly to them, feed off of the ability to corrupt the police, the military, the judicial and legislative systems. That gives them the havens from which they can work. When I was participating within the Medellin cartel, my major contact was a lawyer who was the principal advisor to Pablo Escobar. And although he was a professor at the University of Medellin and a person who outwardly was known to deal with the legislature on laws, really what he was doing was he was paying off the legislature in order to convince them to continue to vote in favor of the non-extradition law that frustrated the U.S.'s ability to be able to prosecute Pablo Escobar and to touch the organization. That type of corrupting ability is achieved when the financial institutions of the world partake in the laundering of the mountains of cash that are generated by those organizations. If they were stuck with the cash, they really couldn't do a whole lot with that. When they turn that into wire transfers and abilities to acquire legitimate appearing companies that operate globally, they create organizations that are tremendously scary. Probably the best case I can think of in the recent past that your listeners should Google, the last name is Juma, J-O-U-M-A-A. So just Google J-O-U-M-A-A and drug trafficking or money laundering, and you'll get what these organizations have become. That case tells the story that many other cases like it in the last few years tells about an alliance between the Mexican cartel leadership, the Colombian cartel leadership, and Hezbollah. So now we have terrorist organizations outwardly working very closely with the cartels. Their interest is to generate revenue for terrorist type activities, and they've tapped into this as well, and it's become a major method by which they can continue to operate their terrorist type activities. But imagine organizations that control, as you'll see in the Juma case, dozens of companies around the world that otherwise appear on their surface to be quite legitimate. Companies involved in free trade zones that move in 40-foot containers legitimate goods within which drugs and money are secreted. It doesn't take a lot of imagination to think that those same very sophisticated systems can be used to conceal hazardous weapons, hazardous chemicals, and penetrate borders around the world with very little challenge.
Robert, we're going to take this break. We're going to come back and talk more with you about this. When you decided to do this, you, of course, risked your life, no doubt. I mean, was there a point where you thought, oh, my gosh, this is it for me?
Well, you know, kind of almost the opposite. I sincerely believe that 99.9% of the law enforcement community, not just in the United States, but in many nations, is driven by a desire to become a part of making a difference. And I always felt that being a part of making a difference meant getting myself as close to the criminal underworld as I possibly could at the highest level to gather the most important information on which we could act. And when I found myself within the highest levels of the Medellin cartel and the corrupt international banking community, I became pretty much an information junkie every
All right.
day.
Stay with us, Robert. We're going to talk more about that. Robert Mazur with us, his book, The Infiltrator. He's with us 2 hours tonight, split show. Back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Robert Mazur with us. Robert, when you were just getting involved in this, what was your motivation? I mean, did you always want to get into law enforcement and be an undercover agent?
No, actually, it was almost really by accident. It was the early 70s. I was in college. I needed some extra money to be able to pay some bills. And I went to the jobs board looking for summer employment and some part-time employment during the semester, and saw this announcement for a job as a co-op student with an agency that I'd never heard of called the Intelligence Division of the IRS. So I really wasn't focused on law enforcement. I was a business administration, finance, and accounting major. And when I went there, I met with some of the senior people in the office and learned that this was the agency that really was responsible for the prosecution of Al Capone for failing to pay income taxes on his illegal profits, that they were working very closely with many different agencies that, on the money side, really putting the paper trail together for those agencies in cases that related to drug traffickers, corrupt politicians, organized crime figures. And so I took that job, and very quickly thereafter really was drawn to the excitement of using accounting skills and white collar investigative techniques to work on a money trail, because the money is really what it's all about. That's why these people, for the most part, are involved in these types of operations. And the first case that when I was in the office that I began to learn about was our involvement in what later became a movie called American Gangster, in the prosecution of Frank Lucas, who was at the time played by Denzel Washington, who was at the time the biggest heroin trafficker in the country, bringing in heroin in the bodies of deceased veterans from Vietnam.
Oh.
And so what we wound up doing in handling the money side of it was surveilling the couriers. And the couriers were going into what was then called the Chemical Bank in New York, and with duffel bags, literally duffel bags full of currency. And depositing it, and the bank not filing the forms that they're required to file to notify the government of large cash transactions, and our office put that side of the case together, prosecuting a few bankers, and the bank wound up pleading guilty as well, and so that was really my real eye opener into how important the money side of to these huge criminal organizations was. And so I worked in the criminal investigation, that became what was known now as the Criminal Investigation Division of IRS. Worked there for a while, and I went on from there to the U.S. Customs Office of Enforcement, and that's where I did the undercover work that's mainly focused in my book, and then went from there on to the Drug Enforcement Administration, where I went back undercover for another 2.5 years. So, but I volunteered after having 14 years on as an agent, doing the traditional types of cases with informants and wiretaps and search warrants. And I was working on a task force that focused on the money laundering of the Colombian cartels. And as we worked together, multi-agencies all working together in that task force, we came to the conclusion that really to effectively prosecute the people involved in the money laundering, we needed to have somebody on the inside. We needed a long-term undercover operation that infiltrated their money laundering structures in order to identify who truly were the beneficial owners of the money and who was actually involved in laundering. So I went through undercover training, and then thereafter spent about 1.5 years putting together what I think is one of the more sophisticated undercover fronts that an agent's been able to use. In that period of time, I became embedded in real businesses, not government front companies, but real businesses. An investment company, a mortgage brokerage business, there's a jewelry chain with 70 locations on the East Coast, and a private jet charter service, and even a brokerage firm with a seat on the New York Stock Exchange. And all of that was put together with some very key informants, one in Colombia, and two who were associated with one of the five crime families in New York. So that was pretty much my badge and my gun, my protection. I never carried a badge or a gun working long-term undercover. But that gave me the confidence that I had the cover that I needed in order to be able to effectively work within the Medellin cartel and slowly work my way up the chain of command, and ultimately dealing with many of the direct reports, people who were reporting directly to Pablo Escobar, as well as the senior management of what was the seventh largest privately held bank, Bank of Credit and Commerce International, that was
BCCI. Huh?
Yeah, it was one of the banks that was handling their money.
Started by a Pakistani with almost no money.
Yeah, and actually a very interesting story about that bank and many of the banks that are involved in the international banking community, at least the private client divisions that or the correspondent banking divisions that handle this type of money. The principal ownership of BCCI was held by the former head of Saudi intelligence. The financial advisor who was assigned to handle my relationship with the bank was a Pakistani whose father formerly was the head of Pakistan's ISI, the equivalent to the CIA, and they also were managing bank accounts of the CIA during the time that I was dealing with them. They were moving monies to the Mujahideen to finance arms purchases while they were in Afghanistan fighting the insurgents of the Russians into Afghanistan back during that time frame. So there was and there is, at least my experience, the people who were involved in handling the drug money laundering were really the same people who were involved in handling very secretive money that the intelligence community had. And that doesn't really surprise me because of the explanations that were given to me by senior management of BCCI. One of the gentlemen, I socialized with them a lot, and one evening, early morning hours, at a social club, said to me, you know who the biggest money launderer in the United States is? And I was a young, eager agent. I thought I was going to get this great bone to bring back to the office, and he said, well, it's the Federal Reserve, of course. I said, what do you mean the Federal Reserve? That makes no sense. He said, well, let me explain this to you. We deal in Colombia through the Bank of the Republic. That's their central bank. And the Bank of the Republic at the time, and you can Google this and confirm it, but the Bank of the Republic in Colombia had a window called the sinister window, the anonymous window. So you could bring at that time as much currency as you wanted to the Bank of the Republic and exchange it for Colombian pesos, no questions asked. Then that Bank of the Republic in turn had their dollar accounts with the Federal Reserve. And so they would put all this cash, billions, hundreds of billions, on pallets and ship it back to the United States, where it would turn into a bank balance for them in their U.S. dollar accounts with the Federal Reserve. And as he explained to me, he said, you know, don't you think somebody in the Federal Reserve is aware of the fact that it is illegal in Colombia to have a U.S. dollar account? So how in the world could the Central Bank for Colombia be shipping hundreds of billions of dollars back to the Federal Reserve unless the money came from the underworld?
That's right.
Yeah, and so he made a great point, and his point also was that, listen, we service money-seeking secrecy. We give the same service to people who have money, drug dealers who want to hide it, arms dealers, could be people pilfering treasuries, people who want to deal with prohibited nations, tax evaders, evaders of customs duty, intelligence community. They all have the same need, and that is moving money around the globe secretly. And most often it's moved by hiding and disguising it to appear as though it's trade-based transactions crossing borders for legitimate reasons. So they gave me quite an education on money laundering, much better one than I ever got in training with law enforcement.
Is it easy, Robert, to trick a banker that way, or is it obvious and they should know this?
Well, you know, there are times when people try to trick the banker, but I really do believe that when you're talking about the big money, there's no tricking that's going on. If you look at there's about a dozen banks that in the last 4 or 5 years have entered into what's called deferred prosecutions. I call it a legal hand slap, admitting criminal guilt in connection with the illegal movement of monies around the world, big money. HSBC is a good example. That's only 4 or 5 months ago. And in HSBC's case, there's 10 years of illegal activity that occurred. There's very, very overt laundering of drug proceeds. There's also the stripping of wire transfers that provided the opportunity for transactions to be handled through Iran in violation of the sanctions. There's many, many other types of criminal activities that they did. And look what happens to the bank. They're fined. They are given a fine, which sounds like a lot, $1.92 billion. But when you really look at it closely, that constitutes 10% of the bank's profits in the year 2012,
that's right.
And that's it.
They made a lot of money, and nobody went to jail, right?
Absolutely no one went to jail, and what really disturbs me about that particular case and some of the other deferred prosecutions that were in the last 3 or 4 years, the architects of that deferred prosecution approach really are a fellow by the name of Lanny Brewer, who was the chief of the criminal division, and Eric Holder. These are two guys who were partners together before they went to the Department of Justice in a law firm called Covington & Burling. Covington & Burling represents the who's who of banks around the world. Now, you would think they would know enough about why, how banks operate and why it's so important to address this threat of banks being involved in this type of illegal activity. But rather than bringing criminal charges against bank officers, they decide that the thing to do is just fine the banks. What's really disturbing is just a month ago.
It's like a partnership, though, Robert, isn't it?
Well, you know what happened just about 2 months ago. Lanny Brewer decided to resign. He went back to Covington & Burling, where he, according to the New York Times, is now going to be receiving $4 million a year, helping them to establish relationships around the world with international banks that they are going to defend in situations similar to the HSBC, or, you know, whatever type of alleged criminal activity that the bank might be involved in.
Jeez.
How can you possibly, you know, I can hear of that type of a thing happening in, say, Mexico or some other countries where maybe that is more common. Here in the United States, I don't understand why the public isn't up in arms that the guy who orchestrated these things, the guy who held up the $1.92 billion fine of HSBC and said it was such a tremendous accomplishment by the federal government, now leaves, nobody gets prosecuted, and he gets $4 billion a year to go back and defend banks. Doesn't make any sense.
Doesn't make any sense at all. And, you know, one of the reasons, Robert, there aren't enough big shows like ours and people like you to go forward and to talk about it. In mainstream television, the networks, you know what? This would be a small little story in their newscasts.
I agree with you. And to just really bring home the point here about these deferred prosecutions, I'd like to just run through a couple of them that were given out. Beside the HSBC one that was given out at the end of 2012, where they paid the $1.92 billion, nobody went to jail. Wachovia Bank, in March of 2010, paid a $160 million fine. Nobody went to jail. What they admitted was criminal conduct in conjunction with their solicitation of $400 billion in deposits from account holders in Mexico, U.S. dollar deposits that were brought in from accounts that were opened in the name of houses of exchange, casas de cambio. These are houses of exchange. There have been alerts that the Treasury Department has given out for more than a decade to the banking industry that those are the types of relationships that require enhanced due diligence because they are most often used as vehicles for the laundering of drug proceeds. Despite that fact, Wachovia opened recklessly many account relationships, some of which were with houses of exchange that had been already identified as being involved and tied to drug trafficking and drug trafficking organizations. They not only brought in $400 billion, they physically transferred through their correspondent bank relationships $14 billion in U.S. currency. Now, I was a money launderer undercover. I used to receive $1 million, $2 million at a given time off the streets of many major cities in the United States.
In cash?
In cash. And most of the time, that was in 5, 10s, and 20s. So now let's take the Wachovia $14 billion being repatriated. Let's make the package the smallest it could possibly be. Let's say it was all $20 bills. If it was all $20 bills, the $14 billion would have weighed 780 tons. Who did they think they were getting 780 tons of currency from in Mexico? Who did they think they were getting $400 billion in U.S. dollar deposits? $400 billion represents one-third of the gross national product of Mexico for an entire year, and their per capita income is $4,000, and that's earned in Mexican pesos. So where did this currency come from? It doesn't take a rocket science or a $1,000 an hour lawyer to tell you. It's most likely tied to one of the major businesses that are in Mexico called the Mexican cartels. HSBC took in much more than that. HSBC repatriated $106 billion U.S. dollars over a period of roughly 3 years. That $106 billion, if it was 20s, would have weighed 5,800 tons. I just don't understand how that kind of thing can go on. But we go to the other banks. Bank Atlantic, this goes back a ways, in April of 06, $10 million, nobody goes to jail. American Express International in 07, $55 million, nobody goes to jail. Union Bank of California in 07, $21.6 million fine, nobody goes to jail. Then we deal with other banks that are involved in tax evasion, like UBS. UBS winds up in February of 09 admitting to criminal conduct, conspiring to help U.S. citizens evade taxes. They pay a $780 million fine. The only guy who went to jail in that case was the bank officer who was the whistleblower who came to the government, the U.S. government, and exposed UBS's involvement in that criminality. Deutsche Bank in December of 2010, $553 million fine and a deferred prosecution. Credit Suisse, $536 million fine in December of 2009, deferred prosecution. ABN AMRO, which is the biggest Belgian bank, in 2010, a $500 million fine. Barclays Bank in August of 2010, a $298 million fine. Ing in June of 2012, a $619 million fine. Standard Charter Bank in 2012, combined, it's about $600 million that they wound up paying. The list is far too long. The number of officers who have gone to jail for their criminal conduct in these banks is very few and far between. And until we start prosecuting the bankers themselves, this is just going to continue because all it is a cost of doing business.
I agree. It's almost like as I said earlier, it's a partnership. You know, the government probably says, we'll get these hefty fines and fees. Let the banks keep doing what they want. The whole thing's an enterprise, Robert.
Yeah, I agree. You know, the only silver lining that I've seen in some of the Senate hearings that have gone on is some very fine work, I think, that has been done by the freshman senator from Massachusetts, Elizabeth Warren, who, if your listeners Google Elizabeth Warren and HSBC hearing, you'll see various YouTube postings of her grilling the leaders of the regulatory agencies and the law enforcement agencies responsible for prosecutions that relate to money laundering. And what she asked all of them, several questions that I thought were fantastic. She said, tell me the last time you've taken the biggest banks on Wall Street all the way to trial. They all stood and looked at each other and ultimately had to admit they have not. They've just never done it. And her question to them was, well, you know, how many billions of dollars? Because we know HSBC was involved in the movement of $881 million in drug proceeds at a minimum.
Hold on, Robert. Hold on. We're at the top of the hour. We're going to come back, talk more with you. We'll also take some phone calls. Lots of folks want to chat with you about this. Unbelievable. Robert Mazur with us. his book, The Infiltrator. He is a former federal undercover agent. We'll be back in a moment.